I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Moss-Cohen and welcome to Radio Times. It's estimated that one-third of all school children in the U.S. are overweight or obese. These figures reflect a growing trend and have serious health implications. Public health officials say that one of the culprits has been the school lunch, which tends to be high in fat and sugar with a premium on processed foods. New federal guidelines went into effect this summer that require school districts to develop policies that promote healthy eating. Some districts have already begun removing soda machines and junk food and are experimenting with cafeteria menu. Today on Radio Times, will students give up their cheesy pizza and soda for fresh fruits and vegetables? We will ask our guests. And here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Allison Carpen. She's Director of Research and Evaluation at the Food Trust, and that's a Philadelphia nonprofit that promotes nutritional education in schools, works to increase the availability of affordable and nutritious foods in communities across the city, and they've been working with the Philadelphia Public School System and other school systems in the region. Allison Carpen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're welcome. On the telephone and joining us for the first half of the program is Marion Nessel. She's a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. Her research focuses on the federal dietary guideline politics, and she's the author of four books, including Food Politics and her latest, What to Eat. Marion Nessel, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Glad
Good
to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Allison Carpen, let me begin with you. And if you could give us a bit of a snapshot slash report card on how you think the Philadelphia region has been doing in dealing with this problem of lousy food in schools.
Well, I don't know that I would say that Philadelphia has solved the food problem here, but I think that if we look across the nation at major school districts, Philadelphia certainly is leading the way in terms of providing some good, solid policies for their youth around school lunch, around snack food, around beverage food. I think that they're doing a great job, really. You look at New York City, they're doing a good job as well. There's other leaders, certainly across the nation, but Philadelphia would be one of them.
And does that also include removing the soda machines and things like that? Have they taken steps to change what's inside the schoolhouse?
Yes, they absolutely have. So several years ago, Philadelphia did adopt a policy to remove the types of products that are in vending machines that people typically would prefer their children not to consume. So there may still be vending machines there, but what they're selling is milk, water, 100% juice.
And I do want to get Marion Nessel in on the conversation, but you told me, Allison, about some new research from your organization that 30% of kindergartners in the Philadelphia public school system are overweight.
That's right. We didn't do a comprehensive look at all kindergartens. What we did was a random sampling of kindergartens. And from our baseline information, we were kind of astounded, really, that how high the obesity rates were among children that age. It certainly is higher than national estimates, but as well, we work with low-income populations who are disproportionately affected by this problem.
To you, Marion Nessel, do you see some of the progress even as you look across the country? Do you think school systems are beginning to take their food lunch program seriously?
Well, I actually see it as a national social movement. It's the most extraordinary thing that's happening in our democratic society these days, is that school districts all over the country are looking at the health problems in children, are looking at what's going on in schools and saying, we just can't go on like this. It isn't that schools by themselves are going to solve the obesity problem. The obesity problem is more complicated than that. But the schools are a reasonable place to begin for several reasons. I mean, one is that you want to feed kids adequately in school. They learn better if they're eating better. And the other is they set an example. They're supposed to be teaching kids about what is healthy and what is good for them and what is good for society. And the schools that have moved into the whole question of where food comes from, how food is produced, how it's served, what it tastes like, what different kinds of foods are, have programs that are just spectacular in their results, maybe not in changing weight so much, but in changing the way that kids relate to food. food. And it is really amazing to go into one of these places and see kids eating things that you would never dream possible.
Well,
broccoli. You know, and liking it and asking for it and being interested in tasting different kinds of foods.
Would it be amazing? Would it be fair to say, though, Mary Nissel, that let's say 100 years ago, schools were concerned about students not having enough to eat, even concerned about malnutrition?
Oh, absolutely, and way less than 100 years ago. Certainly through the end of the Second World War and immediately afterwards, when the school lunch program started to try to make sure that kids were fed adequately during school. Over the years, as food in schools has become increasingly commodified, and what I mean by that is that there are industries that produce foods for schools that make their living off of producing foods for schools, and as the tax structure changed so that schools were not supported as well, schools began to look for the cheapest way to solve the food problem rather than the best way. And that, I think, is what's changing as it's become so obvious that eating a lot of junk food isn't really good for kids.
It might be the cheapest way to feed kids, though, you're saying.
It's certainly the cheapest way, and that, of course, has to do with the politics of food, which have to do with the way certain foods are subsidized and certain foods are cheaper to make. I always say, why is it cheaper to feed kids junky hamburgers and sodas than it is to feed them salads? That has to do with the way our farm support system is set up and the way our food system is set up, and that can be changed. It's not inevitable.
Well, let me turn back to you, Allison Karpin, because you've been working with school districts in the region here around Philadelphia. Are there ways, though, to educate children about food that helps them understand the sort of totality of what eating is about?
Yeah, I think at the one way to look at this problem is that it's just about lunch, and I'm really just not pleased. You know, a parent could say, I'm not really pleased with what my child ate today at school. But another way to look at the problem is much more ecological in nature, where you're considering not only what the individual child is eating in school, but also the environment around the school, the kinds of education the child is getting in the school, what kinds of education is that child bringing home to their parent. I think that's another important mechanism, is how the school food environment relates to parents' attitudes mm-hmm. about what the child will eat. And I know one overarching question here is, will the child eat the broccoli? Will the child eat the red pepper? And certainly nutrition education is a huge part of that. Philadelphia has taken great strides in making sure that every single school in the district now is getting nutrition education. We have many, many programs that are doing nutrition education in schools, but I think it's also important to know that you can't just educate someone. You need to make sure that that food is available also for them once they know that they want to make a different choice.
Well, and I wonder, especially in some poor communities in this city, whether there are, you know, supermarkets that have fresh fruits and vegetables. Or are we talking more about the corner market that has much more processed foods?
Or if they have supermarkets at all.
Or supermarkets at all, exactly.
Right.
You want to speak to that, Allison?
Exactly. Well, I think Philadelphia here has made an, again, I sound like the biggest Philadelphia fan there is, but we have made Pennsylvania, Dwight Evans and Governor Rendell have done a terrific job in helping to pull together financial assistance for supermarkets who want to build in underserved neighborhoods across the state of Pennsylvania. And what that has done is, when we started this work around 1999, Philadelphia was the second worst in terms of the number of supermarkets per residence. And at this point, we're up to number six worst, which still isn't necessarily honorable. But over 5 years, I think we've made a significant dent. And that's an $80 million initiative. Mm-hmm. So I think there's certainly many, many more years to come and many, many more supermarkets to come.
I wonder to you, Marion Nestle, though, how much of this effort to improve the quality of food that kids eat in schools is up against something like corn syrup or the corn industry. Could you speak to that?
Well, I did already in a sense, because we subsidize corn production in the United States through farm supports. And what that does is it encourages corn farmers to produce more corn. And because there's been a huge glut, it lowers the price. And one of the ways in which you deal with it is you make it into corn syrup, or these days, ethanol. And corn syrup is a very cheap, sugary ingredient with no nutrients other than calories. So when you put corn syrup into food products, It lowers the cost and raises the calories without giving the kids the nutrition that they need with it. And there's corn syrup in absolutely everything. So I always ask the question, why does everything have to be sweet? The question of whether kids will eat it is a completely settled question. They will. You go into a school that has one of these programs that's been going on for a while, and it doesn't even have to go on for a very long while before the kids catch on quickly, get interested in food, and will eat absolutely anything that is there if it's taken seriously and if there's somebody there who cares about whether they eat it or not.
Well, Mary Nessa, let me quote something that you wrote in this week's edition of The Nation magazine, a whole series looking at what we eat as Americans. You write, American children consume more than one-third of their daily calories from soft drinks, sweets, salty snacks, and fast food. I underline that only because we're talking about how to increase nutrition in the school lunch program, but it looks like the schools are really up against something bigger than just an individual kid eating an individual meal.
This is a societal problem,
exactly.
And the schools cannot do this themselves. But in the schools that have instituted programs that are working, the kids go home and say they don't want to eat like that anymore. Mm. You know, the biggest problem is with the parents. The parents don't like the kids coming home and saying, we really want healthier food. But there it is, and then it's good for everybody.
When you're nodding your head, Allison Karp, and
yeah,
you're saying,
we've had the same kind of experience. We have a kindergarten initiative where we do nutrition education with the students, and we also really emphasize the relationship between food and the farm. Through that process, we encourage parents to come along with the children to the farm, and we also provide local healthy snack foods 3 times a week to the students. So it's very often that they might get a piece of corn on the cob, or they might get bell peppers, and we have a number of anecdotal stories where the mother was trying to pin down what type of fruit or vegetable it was that the child had tried because they came home asking for that orange vegetable, which turned out to be a cantaloupe.
Well, go ahead, Mary Nessel. I'm sorry. Say that again.
Then they have to supply recipes to parents, and there are schools that do that. No, I think it's one of the most exciting things that's going on in America today is the changeover in the way that schools are dealing with food in kids. And, you know, it's something that parents can do. It's not that hard. You need some luck, and you need a principal who's interested, a school food service director who's interested, and parents can have an enormous impact on what's going on just by going into a school and trying to fix the problem.
And we're about 30 seconds from a break, but to you, Mary Nessel, is it important then that schools cook food for children, or is it still okay for them to heat things up? Does that matter to you?
Well, I think it matters, but this is one of the barriers, and we can talk about the barriers after the break.
Sounds like a producer of Radio Times here. That's Marian Nessel, and she joins us along with Allison Karpin, and we're talking about school lunches and how to improve nutrition in school lunches. And as both of our guests have been saying, there's some real progress when it comes to what kids are beginning to eat in schools, and more schools are taking soda machines out of the hallways, and we're talking about all of this with them. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're particularly interested in hearing from parents in our audience. And do you find the schools in your neighborhood are taking steps to make the food taste good and be nutritious? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Getting a slice of the American pie has always been a fight, especially for immigrants. Today, it's largely Latin Americans in the streets. But 80 years ago, it was Eastern Europeans when 16,000 wool workers in Passaic, New Jersey, decided they'd had enough.
Into every room they scattered with cries of strike, strike.
A radio documentary, Passaic on Strike.
Monday night at 10 on WHYY.
DJ, part news correspondent.
DJ Diplo can tell you what's happening along the Gulf Coast by listening to the music.
There's a lot of protest songs, and they're always really big on the radio. They're just passed around on CDRs and everything. It's just telling real experiences of what's happened there.
Putting an ear to New Orleans a year after Katrina, next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. America's key ally in the war on terrorism, Pakistan, is rocked by civilian unrest. Also, the lost boys of polygamy, young men kicked out of their homes by dads who see them as competition for future wives. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
We're talking about school lunches today on Radio Times with our guest, Allison Karpin. She's director of research and evaluation at the Food Trust, and that's a Philadelphia nonprofit. They promote nutrition education in schools and work to increase the availability of affordable and nutritious foods in communities across the city. And they also work with a number of school districts, including the Philadelphia Public School System and public school systems in the region as well. Mary Nessel is a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University, and she's written a number of books, and her latest one is called What to Eat. Marian Nessel, I want to just pick up on what we were talking about before the break, whether you think it's important that schools have kitchens that are cooking fresh food and slicing fresh salad for kids, or whether it's still okay to just be sort of a heating environment there.
Well, this is one of the barriers, and in New York City, where there's an enormous effort going on to try to improve the food in New York City's 1,000 schools or whatever it is, I'm just an enormous number, one of the problems is that during the period when everybody went to fast food, they took the kitchens out.
Right.
And so all there is the ability to heat things up. And this requires then finding a source of funding for replacing it. It requires dealing with legal issues so that the schools will actually allow people to be cooking. I mean, these are the kinds of things that just drive you crazy when you're trying to think about doing the right thing. But these problems can be solved. They're being worked on. And certainly Philadelphia is setting the standard in the way these things are moving forward.
Before we get some callers in on the conversation, back to you, Allison Karpin. I mean, is there research that says that if you improve the quality of the school lunches, the children will begin to lose weight, certainly the ones that are overweight, and children do get healthier? Do we know that information?
Well, I certainly think that we need a lot more research on this area. There certainly is not one definitive answer that, yes, absolutely, all children are going to lose weight as a result of changing the school lunch, for example. I think, you know, as Marian mentioned earlier, this is a large problem. It's much more in a societal nature than it is in a school level. But we have done some research on a school nutrition policy initiative, which is very similar to the policies now that have been adopted in Philadelphia. And what we found through a randomized study was that we were able to kind of stave off the obesity problem. So where the students were receiving the policy intervention, they no longer became as obese as the children who were in the control schools, those schools that were not receiving the intervention. So it does seem that there's quite a good deal of promise for these types of activities.
Anything you want to add to that, Mary Nissel, then we'll get to our
callers.
Well,
I think this is asking a lot of a school. I think what you want to do in schools is you want to change attitudes. And you want to change practices to the extent possible, and then hope that those will carry over into other areas of life. Lots of things changed in society to encourage people to gain weight, adults as well as children, and these have to do with changes in neighborhoods and tax policies. Schools are only one part of that. Larger portions became the norm. It became okay to have vending machines in schools. All of that is relatively new in American society. And if we're really going to be serious about obesity, we have to reverse a lot of changes that took place during the 1980s. That's almost impossible to do. But you can start someplace. And what is so important about what's going on in schools is that they're a place where you can start and really have an impact.
Let me get to Fran from Paoli to join us. Fran, go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Yes, hi. Great program.
Thank you.
I wanted to share, my daughter actually goes to Kimmerton Waldorf School, and they have an organic lunch program, which is really special, and I realize that that's not something that is typical for the public schools. But I did want to say that, you know, we're surrounded by great farms in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey, and to have that connection with the farm, which I guess was mentioned earlier, is really great. And the other thing that the program has is that it's parents that are volunteering an hour or two a week to help out with this program. So as far as being able to have extra helpers for slicing and doing some of the prep work or even delivering some of the meals to the cafeteria, whatever, that's all done by parent volunteers. And what's nice about that is that it's taking it home, because I think we can only do so much actually in the school. I think so much of it has to come from what's going on at home and kind of reiterating those habits, those good eating habits, and sharing the recipes and all those things with the parents, so that it's something that continues.
Fran, I appreciate your call. Let me give Allison Carbon just a chance to respond to her comments. And is it true that maybe smaller schools and even private schools have a little more leeway to do things like this?
Yeah, I think that is the case. I mean, certainly when you get into the larger institutions, you have the buying issues. I think your point is very well taken. We need to continue to connect kids to the local sources of food when we can. And I think that's a great way, too, to get parents involved and to start to change their ideas about what is healthy in their family and for their kids. I think, too, knowing where your food comes from, knowing your farmer, more and more folks are shopping at farmers markets. The Food Trust runs 19 farmers markets here in the area. And we've done a lot with the agriculture community to try and get some of those small and mid-sized farmers to bring together their products so that larger schools or school districts would have the opportunity potentially to get that food, the local food.
You want to speak to that, Mary Nessa?
Oh,
we're going to have to say goodbye.
One of the things I wanted to point out is how much fun it is for kids to see these farm-to-school programs. It's not only that they're learning and finding out about these things, but you know, eating healthfully isn't punishment. It's really
so
fun. And the kids love it. They love finding out where food grows. They love growing, you know, I don't know, when I was a kid, we grew radishes and carrots in little pots on the windowsill in my classroom. I thought it was a hoot. And the kids still do. So the more they learn about where food comes from, it's not only better for them and better for what they're eating, but it's also better for the local community. It's nice to support local farmers.
Well, on that note, I thank you, Marian Nessel, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And she's a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University, and her most recent book is called What to Eat. And we are talking about eating school lunches today on Radio Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Allison Carpen staying with us for the rest of the hour, and we have another guest who will be joining us in just a minute or two. Allison, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the corner store program that the Food Trust has here in Philadelphia. I ran across some research. I believe it was you all found that the Philadelphia school kids were spending something like almost $17 million a year on buying stuff at the corner store. Half of the kids in the school system shop there, and the typical purchase was something like $2.
That's right.
That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. And I think most teachers who work in the school system will be very familiar with the black bags, which are typically provided to kids after they make a purchase at a corner store. And so what we've done is, again, looking at the larger school environment, a lot of folks told us, you know, we really appreciate the kind of policies that are happening in the schools, but what are you going to do about those black bags with all that junk food in it that the kids are bringing in and out? Obviously, the school district has no control over that sort
right.
of thing.
And we couldn't assume that what they're buying is junk food.
Well, we know what it is. We've surveyed kids extensively over the past 2 years about what they're buying. We actually stand out front the store and we look in their bag and write it down. So we know that they're buying somewhere between around 400 calories worth of food. The great majority of it, 90%, is not what I would consider a healthy product.
Candy, snack food.
Candy, yeah.
Sugar.
Chips, 25-cent bags of chips. Hugs, which are sugar drinks that come in two sizes. And so the corner store problem is a very real one, and it's one that's not often talked about, probably because it's isolated in more of an urban location. But certainly there's a lot that can be done there as well. Part of our financing for supermarkets is also applying to corner stores so they can start to upgrade the refrigeration to provide more fresh foods. And also we're educating the children, and we're trying to help the corner stores get better products in the stores within the range of items that they can at this point, you know, keep.
And I was wondering whether you've found interest, the people that own the corner stores, are they interested in carrying fruits and vegetables, for instance, which are perishable?
Yes. I think that, you know, we've kind of gone along a gradation here. We haven't leaped to 100% fruits and vegetables. You know, we don't want every child eating celery sticks. But what we've tried to do is see about getting more baked chips, see about emphasizing the types of chip products or the snack foods that are already in the store, if they already sell fresh fruit salads, to educate the kids that they're there and to encourage the stores to do more. And they have been very receptive. We have a fantastic community base of corner store owners, grocers associations that have been very supportive at trying to improve this. I mean, this is a large base of their buying.
Indeed, if we're talking numbers. About almost $17 million a year. Let me just reintroduce you, and I do have a guest who I want to get in on our conversation. And we are talking about school lunches today on Radio Times. And here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Allison Carpin. She's Director of Research and Evaluation at the Food Trust, a nonprofit that works to promote nutrition education in schools and in communities across the region. Her organization works with the Philadelphia Public School System and other school districts in the region as well. Joining us now is Ann Cooper, and she's Director of Nutrition Services at Berkeley, California's Public Schools. She's considered a pioneer in the area of school lunch reform, and she works to transform school food by integrating organic foods and fresh produce into the cafeteria menus. And she's got a book coming out actually next week called Lunch Lessons, Changing the Way We Feed Our Children. It's day two in Berkeley, California for the public school kids. And Ann Cooper, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning.
When did you begin to, let me backtrack. Before you got to the Berkeley Public Schools, what was the typical school lunch?
Really awful. Almost all of it. And you wouldn't imagine that of Berkeley, right? I mean, I think that there's a sense that Berkeley is so cutting edge and everything would have been just great here, but almost 100% of the food, probably 95% of the food, was processed, packaged, typical, made from commodity stuff. I won't even almost say food. Things like corn dogs and burritos and chicken fingers and grilled cheese sandwiches, all of which come in frozen in plastic bags and pizza and the grilled cheese sandwiches in the plastic bags frozen. You take them out of the boxes, you heat them in the plastic bags, you hold them in the holding ovens in the plastic bags, and you serve them to children in the plastic bags. I'm not sure that people don't get that the plastic probably goes into the food. But, you know, that's the kind of food we served here.
Not very appetizing.
Ugh, it was awful. It was really awful.
I appreciate your passions. How about today? I mean, this is the second day of school in Berkeley. What are the kids going to eat?
Wow. Well, let's see. At the elementary schools today, the kids are eating either chicken or vegetarian tamales. And the tamales are made by a local woman-owned Hispanic company, and they're being served with rice and broccoli. All of our elementary school students have salad. We have salad bars in every school in the district, and so they have salad as well, and fresh fruit and fresh vegetables at every meal, and milk, of course, because that's reimbursable. And at the middle schools, besides the tamales, they're having, so a couple of the middle schools are having some fresh-made egg rolls, and we have them made by a small Asian company here, and we bake them and not fry them. And they've got a fresh lo mein salad. They also have salad bars. Mm-hmm. And I think that they're also having today an option for a calzone, and their black bean and corn and tomato made by another locally owned company. That's a women-owned company here. Tomorrow, district-wide, everyone's having fresh roasted chicken, fresh mashed potatoes, really made from potatoes. I think roast carrots are on tomorrow's menu.
My stomach is growling. Let me just jump in here because I do want to get back to our other guests, and we've got lots of callers in on the conversation. For you, though, Ann Cooper, and that's a pretty dramatic change from tater tots to the kinds of menu that you just described to us. Was it a matter of educating the kids so that they wanted this stuff? Was it a matter of just doing dramatic changes in the menu and believing that good food is something that kids want? Or was it a slow sort of evolution helping them expand their appetite and their taste buds? Ann Cooper.
So, well, Yes, everything. I've only been with the district 11 months, actually right. 11 months today, and in that time we basically went from 95% processed to 95% fresh.
Right.
So initially what we did is go ahead and change the food, but just because the food is better and just because the food is changed doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get students to eat it. So with the good food and with the changes, you absolutely have to pair it with good education. And here in the school district, I'm not only in charge of all the food, but I also am responsible for all the cooking classes and gardening classes. And we have cooking and or gardening classes at 13 of our 16 schools. We also have curriculum that links agriculture, the environment, food, and health. And it's in the fourth and fifth grade science classes right now. So we have a lot of ways we touch our students.
Well, let me get you back in on the conversation, Allison Carpen, and we do have a lot of callers who want to join us as well. And again, looking at the region here, it's interesting to compare and contrast what's going on in Berkeley. Whether there are efforts to try to do some of the dramatic changes that have happened in Berkeley.
Well, I don't think there's quite an effort to do such a dramatic change. I mean, for one thing, we have 300 schools. I think she just mentioned that they have 16. So the scale is slightly different. But I do think that we're getting kind of our nuts in a line to be able to tackle this problem from an agricultural standpoint, so that we're moving the product, so that the product's available when school systems, and Marion, when she was on earlier, she mentioned the issues of the reheating and not being able to cook in these facilities. I mean, a lot of our schools have a similar problem to what's happening in New York, where we just don't have kitchens. You have staff at this point who don't necessarily cook. I mean, there's a lot of issues that you'd have to address if you were going to do something like that here on a large scale, but at the same time, I think Philadelphia has begun to take some significant steps to getting toward a lot better food in the cafeteria.
And then, Cooper, how many cooks, chefs, food preparers did you have to hire?
Well, interestingly, we didn't hire any in the beginning. I kind of did this with my existing staff, but we had the same issues. Of my 16 schools, I only had three that had cooking facilities. In my central kitchen, where I produce all the food for the elementary schools, we don't even have a stove. So, you know, what we see countrywide, and I think, you know, in almost all school districts, is a real lack of rebuilding of the resources. Kitchens that almost every school originally had a kitchen when these programs were put in place, but as the kitchens deteriorated, they weren't rebuilt. As we saw the advent of processed food, there was no need to have a kitchen. And with the advent of the processed food, there was no need to have cooks and people that actually knew food. So in last year, and in my district that of 10,000 kids and 16 schools, I actually had two people that were considered cooks and no chefs. And so I basically went in the kitchen every day last year. And actually, I was in the kitchen at 5. I just left to come to a quiet office so I could call you. But I go in the kitchen every day, and I help organize the day. Last year, I had one chef consultant, and this year I have two.
You have two. But I mean, it sounds like you need more people to cook food if you're going to prepare fresh food for kids every day.
Well, you don't necessarily need more people. You need more training. In a lot of school districts, I have 55 people on my staff.
Right.
So it's not necessarily that I need more. What I need is definitely training. That's not to say that in some places you don't need more people, but I think that you can, you know, there's things we can do with existing staff if we had training.
And that's Ann Cooper, who joins us along with Allison Carpen, and we're talking about the changing school lunch today on Radio Times, and we do want to get our callers back in on the conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm George, hoping you'll join me for the next edition of Crazy College, when we hit the books as the new school year begins. We'll be auditing a course in comedy with Professor Tom Lehrer. Chubby Checker goes to the head of the class with Randy Newman, and Soupy Sales thinks that the varsity is a drag, when the Happiness Boys go collegiate. All that and then some, next time, when Crazy College heads back to school.
Monday night at 9 o'clock on WHYY.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY TV 12, get help from the guys who know home repair, the This Old House Hour. Then at 9, from Switzerland to Uganda, the United States and the Ukraine travel the world and examine the lives of over 50 people living with HIV and AIDS. Glenn Close and Will Smith narrate A Closer Look. And at 10, how do you raise a family while making minimum wage? POV presents Waging a Living, tonight at 10 on WHYY TV 12.
Fresh Air is celebrating the extended holiday weekend with a country music series. Our series begins on the next Fresh Air with the Dixie Chicks and father and son singers and songwriters Daryl and Wayne Scott. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I'm famous to my...
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM. They all knew I could.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about school lunches today on the program. Joining us by telephone is Ann Cooper. She's Director of Nutrition Services for Berkeley, California Public Schools. She's got a book coming out next week called Lunch Lessons, Changing the Way We Feed Our Children. And here with us, and she's been with us for the whole hour in our Philadelphia studios, is Allison Karpin, Director of Research and Evaluation for the Food Trust, and that's a nonprofit here in Philadelphia. Let me get some more callers in on the conversation, and this is Eliana from Doylestown. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi. Hey, I'm a mom of a four-year-old and also a school teacher as well as my husband. We both teach in public schools, and we recently visited Berkeley, and we were very impressed with the community garden they have at a middle school in the city of Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And we also tried to feed our child healthy food, but in our opinion, what we find to be the hardest thing is not the children, but the parents. And I was wondering if Ann Cooper could enlighten me a little bit on how she did the transition for the parents to change their minds about their food choices and to have healthier food in their homes, so that is
sure
as something that is more suitable for both schools. And I feel that my child, he brings healthy lunch to school, and you know, he sometimes feels uncomfortable because he's the only one who brings a healthy lunch.
Well, and then
he feels he's the different one.
Sure, and you've raised a couple of really good points. Let me toss your first point to Ann Cooper, and this is something we were talking about earlier with Allison Karpin and Marion Nessel, which is, you know, how to involve parents and how to help them be part of this whole effort to improve kids' nutrition. Ann Cooper?
You know, I write a lot about that in my book, Lunch Lessons, that's coming out next week. And I say all the time when I'm speaking to parent groups that it's really the parents. I think one of the things that's really happened over time is it used to be that almost all of our food was prepared by somebody we knew and cared for, and our parents always did that. And then we got into these, everyone's being really busy, time's at a premium, two-income households, and it became much easier to serve processed food. And we have so we're almost a whole generation away from cooking.
Hmm.
So what we're trying to do, besides that I wrote this book that I hope will help parents, is we do a lot of outreach. I meet with parent groups here in the school district on a monthly basis. I'm going to all the back-to-school nights. We're doing community outreach with a couple of local advocacy groups. And with those community outreach, we're going into different venues, faith-based organizations in some instances. We're going out into the community. We're doing tastings. We're doing cooking classes. We're going into farmers markets and also the subsidized farmers markets that we have here in Berkeley, talking to parents, talking to kids. We're having kids. We're training high school students to do demos for families. So we're really, it's the social marketing piece and
sure.
the real teaching and education with parents is almost harder than it is with the kids. And you're right, you know, it's very difficult and it takes a lot of time and it takes coordination. It's the cooking classes, it's the outreach, it's continually trying to touch the parents and tell them what the options are.
You want to add to that, Allison Karpin?
Well, we've had very similar findings. I did some focus groups recently with teenage moms. So they were mothers who were in the school system and had children of their own, many of whom actually were married too. And so they were really talking to me about preparing food for their kids. And it was very clear that we are now starting a generation who has no role model of cooks in the family, especially in the urban neighborhoods. It's we've become so fast foodized that they wouldn't even know how to cook if you asked them to, you know, something their great grandmother did. It's just
for them,
almost
a
memory.
It's a microwave. It's heating.
It's on the go.
Well, and I wondered, we could do a whole hour about how kids then will trade their lunches, but that was another question that Eliana had about, you know, you pack a healthy lunch for your kid, you go to school, you don't know whether they've eaten it or not, thrown it in the trash, traded for chips. Any suggestions, Ann Cooper, and then we'll get back to our other callers.
No, you know, I really think that kids trading food, it happens. I think that there's something really wonderful about sharing food, and one of the things we struggle with here in Berkeley is that we really want kids to understand that sharing food is a really wonderful thing to be cherished. And on the other hand, within the schools, especially at the younger level, there's a lot of, you know, I want what you have and you want what I have, and parents are packing these really lovely lunches, and then the student sitting next to them is having a Lunchable or, you know,
tater tots.
Or tater tots or something that, you know, we should ban. So, I mean, I think that that's, again, it's an educational piece, and I'm not sure, you know, that we can really tackle that.
You have to be patient, right?
Yes.
Allison, anything you want to add to that before we get back to our callers? All right, let me get Dennis from Booth Wynn to join us. Hi, Dennis. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. That's really interesting what she said about cooking, because we're kind of lucky. My wife's a great cook, and she's a dietitian, so we've always eaten kind of healthy. And what's interesting is that our kids never liked the lunches at schools.
Hmm.
So we've always packed their lunches at, right on through high school.
Was that because it was cheesy pizza and tater tots and things like that, or was it because it was something else?
I don't know. I don't know. I never really. They just didn't like. What
they just
served.
Didn't like the food.
They just, you know, I guess just wasn't what they were used to. They didn't like it. It just didn't taste right to them, I guess. It's not how they were brought up. So we've always packed their lunches. And like I said, right on through high school. In fact, this is the last year for my son. He's a senior. Yahoo. And we're packing.
<Good for you. laughs>
But one thing that's kind of got me upset is you try to pack a healthy lunch, right? And then you want to put something in there to drink. And, of course, you don't want to put a soda in there if you pack the healthy lunch. So we always challenge to try to find something good to drink. So we kind of settled on the green teas, like the Arizona teas and things. That's fairly healthy, I think.
Well, you know, Dennis, hold on one second there, only because Allison Carpen, I have to say she made a face when you said that. Go ahead,
uh-oh.
Allison.
Uh-oh.
Go ahead, Allison.
Well, I think that we look at the nutritional value of drinks, and a lot of your teas and your lemonades and things like that, while perceived as being healthier options, still have a very high sugar content with a lower nutrient value.
Something to keep in mind. Dennis, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about efforts across the country to improve the quality of school lunches, and some recent research has found that as many as a third of school kids in this country are overweight or obese. Let me go back to you, Ann Cooper, and you describe, you know, what's on the menu for today in the Berkeley public school system, and it sounds, you know, really tasty. How much more expensive is it to do really the kind of home cooking or even restaurant cooking that it sounds like is going on in your district?
Well, it's really home cooking, not restaurant cooking. From a food cost standpoint, it's costing us about 50 cents more for food. And
per student, per meal?
Per lunch.
Per lunch.
Per lunch. So it's costing about 50 cents. And, you know, I'd like to put that in a bigger perspective for the audience here. You know, the entire National School Lunch Program, which we pay for in our tax dollars, costs $7 billion to pay for 27 million children to eat lunch every day, about 180 days. It's not a lot of money, although you hear $7 billion, that's such a huge amount. But, you know, if you look at what very recently the San Francisco Chronicle wrote, that the war is costing $2.5 billion a week. I mean, it's minuscule what we're spending on school lunch. And what the CDC has recently reported is that we spend $117 billion a year on diet-related illness. And I think if we could see school lunch and see what we feed children as a health initiative and start to really understand that, you know, food and what we eat really has a direct relationship to our health, then maybe we could find ways to spend more money on the food in our schools so that we had lifelong wellness later on in our lives.
Let me just pick up on that and put it back to you, Allison Karpin. We were talking earlier about the sodas in schools, the soda machines in schools, and many schools use that as a way to make money, to pay for art programs or sports events or things like that. If you take them out of the schools, do schools have to scramble to try to figure out where to make up the cash?
Well, I think that's another question that's definitely open for a lot of debate.
Yeah.
But one kind of compromise I know that we felt we made here in the Food Trust was in Philadelphia to not take the vending machines out altogether, just to stock them with a different line of products. I know in New York City they've done a very similar kind of angle at the vending machine issue, because you're right. The other thing is, the reality is, in Philadelphia we were able to tackle the problem along the timeline of contracting, but in other districts they might already have, say, 10-year contract put in place or a 5-year contract put in place, and once those things are in place, you kind of have to work within the parameters of those contracts.
And put pressure on whoever their contract is to stock it with, what, less sugary sodas? Or?
Yeah, we do milk, water, and 100% juice.
I wonder, too, and this is, again, one of these global issues, even though we're talking about school lunches, and I'll toss this back to you, Allison Karpin, about, you know, here in Pennsylvania, we worry about losing farmland, and yet you've got schools that could probably use some of the products that come from a farm locally. I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about some farm initiatives, and I'll toss the same kind of question to Ann Cooper. Go ahead, Allison.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. If we could start with a few commodities that Pennsylvania grows locally, that would, you know, be a shoe-in for the school district. One thing that we've done a few times was called the Great Apple Crunch, where we put information out about apples, about the nutrient value of apples, and at the same time had local apples put into the school system so that day all the children got apples. So I think there are ways that we can start to take steps to move more local Philadelphia or, you know, Pennsylvania, within 150 miles of our region here, food into the schools. It makes a lot of sense. You know, we worry about gas prices and we're paying a lot to ship our food far.
So why not do it locally? And to you, Ann Cooper, there's the edible schoolyard in Berkeley. This is an idea of Alice Waters.
Yes, and the edible schoolyard, which Alice started, I think, almost 12 years ago now, is in one of our middle schools. And it really was the inspiration for us having cooking and gardening programs in almost all of our schools here in Berkeley. And at the edible schoolyard, students actually cook in the kitchen and garden in the garden and bring the food from the garden into the kitchen and really touch it that way. The other thing that we have here in California is something called the California Nutrition Network, and that actually funds all of my cooking and gardening programs. So we actually have all of our students in the district, well, almost all of our students in the district have either cooking or gardening programs available to them in their schools, and in the schools that have them, they actually have to take these programs, so it's not just an optional thing. And so we really get to touch kids with food, show them how it's grown, let them taste it, and that certainly helps. One of the things we just did, I'm handing them out today, I'm actually very proud of them, we produced a calendar with the menus for the entire year.
Yep.
And tied it to a seasonal product.
Wow.
So September is tomatoes. So I have a tomato recipe that the students are being taught in their classrooms, and that same recipe we're serving in the cafeterias and sending home to the parents and asking them to cook it at home. So we're really trying to, again, do that outreach and connect what the kids learn in the classroom to what they eat in the cafeteria to what they might be able to eat at home as well.
You've been busy, Ann Cooper.
There's actually the same program here in Pennsylvania. It takes a slightly different angle, but the USDA's food stamp education program definitely is also alive and well here in Pennsylvania. It also funds the Eat Right Now program, which is the program of the school district where they do outreach across all the schools to do nutrition education. It also includes samplings and food tastings. They send out recipe cards, things like that.
Let me get Stacy from Collingswood to join us. Stacy, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a first grade teacher in Camden, New Jersey. And I'm in a school where they're, like you were talking about, there's no kitchen. They bring in sort of like cardboard box lunches and just heat them up on site. So there's no cooking. The food is really processed. It's not very healthy. My kids don't have an opportunity to go to a supermarket for the most part. So everything they're eating is coming from the corner store. They have candy for breakfast. It's awful. And to me, at least in this year or next year, I don't see school or district-wide change happening. So I was wondering if you have some suggestions for curriculum or resources that teachers and parents can use sort of in the classroom on a daily basis.
Stacy, let me toss your question first to Allison Karpin, only because she works with schools locally, and Camden, of course, very much in our listening area.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Allison.
I think the problem you described, Stacy, I can really sympathize with. we do have a number of resources on our website, www.thefoodtrust.org. All of our curriculum is available there. I believe it's all downloadable free. And there's certainly, I'm sure Ann Cooper has a number of other pieces of curriculum that you can use. I think, too, as a teacher, you know, we have teachers who care really deeply about this problem, whether it's from a personal perspective or just because they see the kids with the stomach aches by 9 or 10 o'clock because they've been eating junk for breakfast, to try and really encourage the kinds of foods that are coming in as snack foods for your classroom to be healthier. There's some small steps, you know. I agree you need a supermarket in Camden, and there probably can be a lot more that could be done in school food as well.
Sure, and Ann Cooper, you want to add anything? We're almost out of time here, but any other suggestions for Stacy?
Yes, Stacy, just as far as internet-accessible curriculum, you should look at ecoliteracy.org, and they have a whole section named Rethinking School Lunch. You can get there from my website, which is chefann.com, or ecoliteracy.org, and there's a lot of website and other stuff available there.
Well, I thank you, both of you, so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Allison Karpin, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And Ann Cooper, thank you as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Ann Cooper is Director of Nutrition Services for the Berkeley, California Public Schools. She's got a new book coming out next week called Lunch Lessons, Changing the Way We Feed Our Food. Allison Karpin is the Director of Research and Evaluation for the Food Trust, and that's a Philadelphia nonprofit. And earlier in the hour, we heard from Marion Nessel, and she's a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU. And her latest book is called What to Eat. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. In this first hour of the program, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Leave us an email and find out more about the program. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. You're listening to WHYY FM, Philadelphia, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, and worldwide at whyy.org.